Scholar, are you prepared to proceed? Please do.
May I begin?
Yes, please.
Madam Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, I am Hannah Schieber-Durst, and it is my great privilege to be here today on behalf of Mr. Lamont Scholar. I am going to focus my argument on two main points. First, Strickland's primary concern is the fairness and reliability of the proceeding, not its outcome. Second, handing a deliberating jury inadmissible, prejudicial other acts evidence is the prime example of an error that undermines the confidence in the fairness of the trial as a whole.
You say prejudicial. Was it prejudicial as to all counts?
Yes, Your Honor, the error was prejudicial.
Even though all the courts below agree, they are uniform in their agreement that there was overwhelming evidence as to the majority of counts.
Yes, Your Honor, the courts below did find that the error was not prejudicial as to the five remaining counts. The flaw in those analyses is that they looked only to the weight of the evidence and did not take into consideration the nature of the error.
But yet, when we consider the prejudicial nature of the evidence, we are to look to see the analysis that the reviewing court is to use is to determine whether there is overwhelming evidence of guilt. And it seems to me that the thrust of your argument, in fact, not just the thrust, but the main point is that prejudice as to one count, here the sexual assault, which everyone agrees there is less evidence. We might even call it shaky, for the reason that, as in most sexual assault cases, typically there are no witnesses. Typically, objective evidence besides the classic he said, she said cliche is not going to be there. You are asking us to say, disregard the overwhelming evidence on the trafficking count. Focus solely on the sexual assault count. And because it was prejudicial on that, it must have been prejudicial on all, even though there was overwhelming evidence as to the other five counts. Yes?
That's not what I'm asking the court to do. What
okay.
I'm asking the court to do is, under Strickland, the prejudice analysis must take into consideration not just the weight of the state's evidence, but the nature of the error itself. And when I say nature of the error, what I mean is the deficiency.
It's a two-step process, yes.
Well, it's not just the nature of the error doesn't just go to whether counsel performed efficiently. Strickland explicitly says that the type of error is going to shape its prejudicial effect. So Strickland says that there are certain errors that will have pervasive effects on the inferences to be drawn from the evidence, altering the entire evidentiary picture. And Strickland says there will be certain types of errors that will have isolated, trivial effects. So knowing that, you also look at whether certain findings would be unaffected based on the nature of the error.
There was a co-defendant here, right? There was a separate actor, Simmons, I think.
Yes, they were not tried together, but that, yes.
And at the Mockner hearing, Scholar's attorney testified that his theory of the case is that it was all Simmons. Simmons was the bad actor.
Right.
And that by letting the document in, the exhibit in, that he had reviewed the exhibit, and in his estimation, in his analysis, the exhibit actually bolstered his theory of the case that it was Simmons who was the bad actor. That's my recollection of the testimony at the Mockner hearing?
That was some of his testimony. The court found concerning, the Mockner court found concerning, that defense counsel appeared to believe that once his request to suppress these phone records was denied, that there was no other way to in any way limit what went back to the jury.
But as to my question, that was the lawyer's belief as far as his strategy, right? That the text messages reduced to writing implicated Simmons and was therefore consistent with his theory of the case.
That was one of the things that the attorney said, though again I would note the state has conceded that this exhibit going back to the jury was deficient, so we've already established deficient
which,
performance.
Which, of course, we are not bound by.
Well, in fact, I would say this court is bound by that determination because the state did not file a cross appeal from the court's order vacating that count and from the court's order deciding that counsel was deficient. The Court of Appeals, the state conceded it at the Court of Appeals, and the Court of Appeals in its decision noted that the state had conceded those points.
We cannot independently review the record for deficient performance?
Well, I think that would be very problematic in this case because the lower court...
I can see why you would take that position, but I don't see where that limits our power to do that.
It would run against the rules of forfeiture. It would run against the fact that the lower court is supposed to have the opportunity to have addressed that question, which the Court of Appeals here did not have.
But our review is independent.
Review of the issues that are before the court, and I would say that that issue is not before the court. But even beyond that, the Mockner court's concern was that even if that was part of counsel's strategy, to send it back to the jury without any redaction was problematic given the overwhelming inadmissible other acts evidence and the over 150 pictures of multiple women in sexually suggestive poses.
All of which had been introduced by means of the back page ads.
That's incorrect, Your Honor. The state argues that this, in essence, was cumulative. It was not. So taking the pictures, for example.
I will confess I did not review any of the pictures, and I certainly, by definition, didn't do a side-by-side. So I am handicapped in that regard by going by what is submitted on the briefs.
So I can tell Your Honor that the state admitted through other exhibits back page ads with photographs of women. These back page ads included EC and SG, the two alleged victims in this case. They also included back page ads of other unknown women, many of which the state did not offer any or did not attempt to connect to Mr. Scholler, and in fact, EC said some of those women were working for Mr. Simmons. Of the photographs of EC and SG, by my count, the jury saw through back page ads 9 photographs of them in suggestive poses total. Compare that to this exhibit, which contains over 150 pictures of far more than 2 women in sexually suggestive poses.
But does that go to the trafficking issue?
Absolutely. The jury asked to see early in its deliberation certain text messages relating to pimping. They didn't ask to see pictures, and they only asked to see certain text messages. And instead of addressing or limiting their request, the defense counsel agreed, without instruction or without limitation, to show them this, to give them this in its entirety.
All right, so counsel, I'd like to explore a little bit about how that affects each of the counts. Strickland says, quote, "The question is whether there is a reasonable probability that absent the errors, the fact finder would have had a reasonable doubt respecting guilt," correct?
Yes.
Okay. And juries determine guilt on a count-by-count basis, correct?
Yes.
All right. So why would it not be appropriate for us to review prejudice on a count-by-count basis?
Well, the problem with just looking at the evidence, the strength of the evidence, as the be-all, end-all of Strickland...
It's not that. The question is, whether there is a reasonable probability that absent that error, the fact finder would have had a reasonable doubt, right? That's the standard that we're looking at.
Yes.
All right, so we look at the prejudicial performance, we compare that to what a reasonable probability would be on what a jury would do absent that error.
Right.
Right? Okay, so we're making that comparison, and that's a legitimate comparison to make, yes?
Yes.
All right, so why can't we do that count by count?
Because the Strickland tells us that when evaluating prejudice, we have to consider whether errors are, whether the deficiency itself was the type of error that would have a pervasive effect on all of the inferences to be drawn from the evidence, mm-hmm. or whether it would have an isolated effect.
Right. So we take that whole package that you held up, and we compare that to the sex trafficking counts, right? And we can say, well, did this information that was erroneously admitted, did that create such a problem with respect to the sex trafficking counts that we have to find that there's a reasonable probability that absent that error, the jury would have had a reasonable doubt?
The problem here is the very reason we exclude other acts evidence, of the pervasive effect it has on the way that the jury looks at everything. So the jury was not just handed this exhibit and told only to consider it with regard to the sexual assault charge. The jury was handed this exhibit in the context of a question about pimping. And so there's no way to cleanly isolate that error to particular counts because it colors the way the jury looks at everything else.
Right. So but what we're trying to get at is how the jury looked at, because as you acknowledged, the jury operates on a count-by-count basis. So what we're trying to figure out is how did that evidence impact how they view those other counts, right?
Right. And this evidence would have impacted the way that they viewed the other counts because it showed the jury, not just on the sexual assault charge, but on all of the other charges, that Mr. Scholler was a violent man, a man who would threaten people with a gun, that he was dealing heroin and prescription pills, and that he had pictures of far more than the two women he was charged with pimping
in
suggestive poses.
Yeah, so you can make counsel.
Justice Abrahamson is on the phone.
The appellate court, as I understand it, does not act as a fact finder to determine whether or not the conviction should be, whether he should be convicted. And the reasonable probability is that under Strickland, you always have to look at all of Strickland. Strickland has a number of different ways that it sets forth a prejudice. And a reasonable probability is a probability sufficient to undermine the confidence in the outcome. And the appellate court, and this is tricky, doesn't really reweigh the evidence to decide if it were on the jury. It would have convicted. And I think that's the important thing. So I want to know what standard are you applying for prejudice?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the last part of your question, Your Honor.
What is the standard? What's the word from Strickland that you are using to determine prejudice?
Well, it's reasonable probability that but for the error, the outcome would have been of the proceeding would have been different.
Does the court reweigh the evidence to decide that?
The court, as one part of the Strickland prejudice analysis, can look at the evidence, but the court isn't, as Your Honor noted, the jury. And so the question is whether the error undermines our confidence in the outcome. So it's not a question of could the state have gotten to that result absent the error. It's whether the error undermines our confidence in how the state got to the outcome.
So, counsel,
Strickland says the ultimate focus is on the reliability of the outcome and the fundamental fairness of the proceeding as a whole. And I think that's what you have to keep looking at Strickland, because it's not just weighing the evidence and saying, hey, would 12 people convict?
Right. It's no, and that goes to State v. Sanchez, where this court has consistently used a totality of the evidence test for that purpose.
And I think,
well,
right?
I think, no. I don't think so.
Go ahead and answer my question.
Strickland tells us we do look at all of the evidence before the jury, but returning...
And Sanchez says in order to do that, we use a totality of the circumstances test. It clarified Strickland.
Looking at all of the evidence.
Yes.
Yeah. Yes. Okay. But returning as well to your question, Justice Kelly, the reason why the nature of the error, why Strickland tells us we have to consider the nature of the error in deciding whether we can divide prejudice, is because the ultimate benchmark of Strickland is whether there was a breakdown in the adversarial process such that it undermines our confidence in whether this produced a just result.
Okay,
so
and the just, and that's right. So now, what undermines our confidence that the just result was reached is if there is a reasonable probability that absent that error, the jury would have had reasonable doubt, right?
Right, but
because we're not interested in giving a new trial when there's no reasonable probability that a jury would find reasonable doubt.
Reasonable probability is, Strickland tells us, if we have to show that there's more than that it's more than conceivable that this would have affected the outcome, but reasonable probability doesn't require that we prove it definitively affected the outcome.
I understand that. It means you have, at a very minimum, you have to assign a reason. Here's the reason a jury could find reasonable doubt.
So
right?
The reason that a jury could find reasonable doubt as to all of the other charges, given this error, is that because it is the very reason articulated by the Mockner Court. Quote, the messages and the pictures are, in my opinion, so inflammatory that I think a jury then and there might have convicted him of virtually anything. There were gaps in the state's evidence. And so giving the jury this, in essence, book of the ways that Mr. Scholler is a bad person and of pictures depicting far more than two women told the jury that, gave the jury reason to convict him for the wrong reason.
Right. So taking that as a given. You can show that with respect to each of the counts, right? You can come to court and say, look, here's the inadmissible evidence that came in. Here's how it affects the sex trafficking charges. You can do that, right?
Yes.
So shouldn't that be your argument to us? We can show here, you mentioned that there are gaps in the state's case, and so here's the inadmissible evidence, and here's why a jury could have why there could be a reasonable probability a jury would have reasonable doubt about guilt because of this inappropriate information. But if you can't make that connection, why would the defendant be entitled to a new trial?
Because Strickland tells us that the ultimate harm that is at issue here is the deprivation of the effective assistance of counsel protected by the Sixth Amendment. So when a defendant meets the incredibly high burden to show that his attorney performed far below any reasonable standard, then what we've shown is a breakdown of the adversarial process.
So that's prong one. Now we need to get to prong two.
And so what Strickland tells us is because of that, our standard for relief, giving the defendant relief, has to be lower, and our expectation of finality has to be lower, because the defendant has established that this was no longer a fair fight. So it's difficult to come back and cleanly isolate how prejudice could just be pulled out because the fight wasn't fair. And so the adversarial system that we place our trust in wasn't there.
But counsel, you don't have to isolate. You take the same evidence that you used to show that there was prejudice in count five, and use the same thing to show there's prejudice in counts one through four.
And so we've recognized in our brief.
Go ahead.
We've recognized in our brief that there may be circumstances where because of the nature of the error, it truly could be isolated to a particular count. But the reason why prejudice could potentially only be isolated to a particular count in a trial, in situations where it's the nature of the error, I didn't explain that very well. What I mean is the reason why Strickland can only be fairly divided if the deficiency of itself, the deficiency itself only goes to one count, is because, again, then and only then could we have perhaps trust that the adversarial system was functioning with regard to the other counts. I think one other thing that's important for this court to keep in mind that may go to the concern, or that goes to your concern about why can't we just divide prejudice, is that there's the risk that if this court here recognizes that lower courts may engage in essence, micro-prejudice analyses, that would in turn open the door to other micro-prejudice analyses, particularly coming from the defense. And Justice Thomas, actually, in a recent 2017 dissent, warned of the fear of such micro-prejudice analyses. That was in Lee versus United States, which is a ineffective assistance of counsel claim in the context of defendant getting inaccurate advice and entering a plea.
Counsel, if Mr. Scholler had only been charged with one count of sex trafficking, would we be capable of looking at the evidence you have there and determining whether there is a reasonable probability the jury could reach a reasonable doubt? Would we be capable of doing that?
If this were just a one count?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. And if we add a count of sexual assault, why does that mean that we are no longer capable of determining whether that same evidence would create a reasonable probability that a jury would find a reasonable doubt?
It's not a question of the court's capability to do that. It's a question of Strickland's focus, which is on the fairness of the proceeding and the right to the effective assistance of counsel. So the state here argues that you have to address, the remedy has to be tailored to the injury. The injury is the loss of the effective assistance of counsel. And here,
I think that's an incomplete statement, counsel. Okay. The injury is a loss of that right that has an impact on the result or a possibility of an impact, right? We can't separate those out. It's not just a question of whether everything was according to Hoyle. That's the first prong. Okay, fine. We've concluded things were not according to Hoyle. The next step is to figure out what effect did that have.
Right.
We're looking at effects. So we've already got your concern taken care of with respect to this, the question of whether he was getting effective assistance of counsel with respect to his performance.
Right.
Now we have to figure out, did it have such an effect on the result that there's a reasonable probability the jury could come to a different conclusion? And in that, I can't make a connection about why, if there's a single count of sex trafficking, that we're capable of making that analysis, but that if you add a sexual assault charge, all of a sudden we're no longer capable of doing that in a constitutionally meaningful way.
I think the answer to your question again comes back to Strickland itself, which focuses on the fairness of the proceeding as a whole. And this is one trial, it's one proceeding. But again, we acknowledge that there could be times where prejudice could be cleanly divided.
Okay,
this is not,
if I may, why in this situation, counsel? Certainly if you have a jaywalking claim and a homicide case, that's an easy one, probably. Here we have two offenses that both start with sex. So they have something in common. But we have to go a little deeper than that. So why in some cases, if you have a single sex trafficking and a single sexual assault, could it be divisible? But you're arguing in this case it could not be.
Because of the nature of the error, and that is the giving the jury early into its deliberations prejudicial other acts evidence. Strickland tells us that there are errors that are going to have pervasive effects on the entirety of the evidentiary picture. This is the prime definition or an example of that type of error.
And if it didn't have that kind of exhibit of those many, many pages with many, many pictures exhibiting what it is, you may not be here today. In part, it's the nature of the exhibit together with the nature of the charge.
Absolutely. And I think the fact that this was given to the jury in its deliberation without any sort of instruction limiting it, with the jury having already been instructed to consider all of the evidence before it, including exhibits, given as another example that after the jury requested to see this exhibit, they continued deliberating, and then they asked to see EC's phone records. Well, he wasn't charged with sexually assaulting EC. So we have a jury who is questioning the state's evidence on the other charges, and they're doing that while deliberating, having been shown this exhibit that tells them, for inadmissible reasons, that he is exactly the type of man to commit this offense. Thank you.
Good morning, Justices, and may it please the Court. My name is Lisa Kumpfer, and I represent the state of Wisconsin. Your Honors, what Mr. Scholler is asking you to do is depart from all 49 states, all 11 circuits, and the United States Supreme Court statements on how a court is supposed to assess ineffective assistance of counsel. Strickland itself states very clearly that the test for prejudice is not whether an error had some conceivable effect on the outcome of the proceeding. And that is exactly what Mr. Scholler is asking you to find here. He has not addressed any of the language in Strickland that says that the prejudice analysis must be limited to how it would affect the verdict or how it would affect the decision reached or any of the language talking about assessing the totality of the evidence that was actually before the jury and comparing that to how the error might have affected the findings on that finding or verdict or the decision reached. If we were supposed to consider a trial as simply a one whole proceeding that had to be considered without any kind of division on the different separate charges, why are we giving juries forms asking for different verdicts on the different charges? We recognize that charges are separate, the evidence is separate. And yes, there are sometimes errors that may have some kind of pervasive effect on the decision that the jury is going to make. But, Your Honors, if you haven't looked at this exhibit, I urge you to do so, because I feel like it has been greatly misrepresented what is actually contained in this exhibit. I personally went through it last night. I counted 300 text messages that Counsel for Scholler has pointed out as supposedly prejudicial. This entire exhibit is in code.
It's
in code, Your Honor. It's in text message speak. It uses a bunch of terminology that no reasonable juror is going to know. In fact, Mr. Scholler had to find the definitions and provide them for the court in the brief so that this court would understand what they meant.
The trial judge here is let me talk about the Mochner hearing judge. The Mochner hearing judge, as I recall, said after looking at the 181 pages of obscene photos and text messages about the drug dealing and guns and prostitution, said, I think a jury then and there might have convicted him of virtually anything after the jury saw that. That's a pretty strong statement about prejudice and how it affects potentially.
Is that what the trial court said, or was that what the trial court quoted a case on point? I don't remember that as being the trial court finding in this.
That was what the Mochner court said after it had already determined that the exhibit was not prejudicial as to the sexual trafficking charges.
That's right, because it was a separate offense. Well, then how do you explain this again? I don't think it was cited in a
separate
case.
Yeah, a little
bit
of a difference.
So what I think that the
let me, if I may, make sure my question is understood.
Accurate.
Let me, if I may, make sure my question is understood. As the Lochner Court stated regarding the inflammatory nature of the text, quote, I think a jury then and there might have convicted him of virtually anything, and I think that's citing the record 107.40. So that seems like a pretty broad statement. Can you explain how that doesn't relate to an analysis of prejudice in this case?
Yes, Your Honor. If you look at the totality of the Mochner transcript, I think it's very clear that what Judge McAdams meant there, first of all, what he found actually prejudicial was the wealth of pictures. When he was going through, right before he made that statement, he said, I think, you know, most of these messages were mundane. I think it was a reasonable strategy to have shown that Mr. Scholler was not mentioned in any of them. But what I can't get over is sending the jury these pictures. I think after that, the statement that you're talking about, I think what Judge McAdams meant was if a jury had heard no evidence and was just handed this exhibit, then they would have convicted him of anything. I don't think that what he was trying to say was this was so inherently prejudicial that even though we have this overwhelming evidence presented by the state, and again, I urge Your Honors to go look at the record in this case, the state did present just simply a wealth of evidence on these sex trafficking charges. And as I mentioned in my brief, almost all of the things about which he was complaining, the jury already saw through other properly introduced evidence, including many of the pictures, as you said, Justice Gableman, were actually put up from the jury, or in front of the jury, and the detective that went through the phone compared them and said, yes, this is the picture that is on a back page ad.
And I didn't do, as I mentioned with your opposing counsel, I didn't do a side-by-side comparison. I went by the briefs. Do you have an idea of approximately how many of the photographs were included in the exhibit that, and you, in your brief, in the state's brief, the state did refer to it as opposing counsel references cumulative, about how many had already been viewed or had been introduced by other means?
I can't make a definitive statement on exactly how many because it's been a while since I've actually had the record in front of me. But as I recall going through that, going through those exhibits and going through the pictures, it was almost all of them.
Okay.
Almost all of those pictures had either been introduced to the jury by showing them those back page ads or by Detective McQuone, who got up on the stand and said, yes, this picture is the same picture on the back page ad, and it's the same one that we found on Mr. Scholler's
phone.
Since
I asked your opposing counsel about it, and I had a discussion with her about it, I want to give you the opportunity to talk about it, about deficient performance. And that went to when I read the comments or the testimony of the trial counsel at the Mochner hearing saying, listen, my theory of the case, my defense, was that Simmons did it. Simmons was the main actor. And my reasoning for allowing this exhibit to go back to the jury is because I believed that the exhibit bolstered my defense, that Simmons was the main bad actor. And I wonder, your opposing counsel made reference to a concession and then a forfeiture. Has the state conceded deficient performance?
The state did not dispute deficient performance in the Court of Appeals. The state contacted the relevant parties and just decided that that was not something that we were going to cross-petition on. However, Justice Gableman, as you noted, deficient performance is a question of law that this court can take up de novo. And personally, I do feel that counsel gave a reasonable explanation for why he wouldn't have wanted this, or why he wouldn't have wanted to parcel this out and only give the jury text messages that implicated his client when you have, as I said, I believe his name came up three times in these text messages, and the letter L was about nine times.
Scholar's name was three times.
Yes, Scholar's name was three times.
All of the text messages, Scholar was mentioned three times.
Exactly. And that's out of 1,400 text messages. And as I said, there are many of these text messages came and went with no contact information. It's just a phone number. A lot of the messages that Mr. Scholar contends are prejudicial were incoming messages.
And my understanding of the trial testimony, one of the things opposing the Mr. Scholar's brief points out is there was reference to him having beat a case after a year. He's texting someone. But my understanding is that he testified in front of the jury about having been in prison. Yes?
What Mr. Scholar testified to was that he had four prior convictions. The state, on rebuttal, introduced a recording of Mr. Scholar's interview in jail when they were asking him for consent to get this phone, and there he admitted, I've been to prison three times, I've beat this other charge. So it was in front of the jury.
And then he said something about, I've been in prison. So the jury had already heard him saying, I've been in prison, and then I fought a case for a year, and by the grace of God, I beat it.
Yes.
So I guess I'm having a tough time discerning what exactly they found out through the exhibit that they had not already found out through all of the things that had already been introduced.
And it's my position that they didn't find out anything that they didn't already know. That's which is why the state's position is there simply cannot possibly be prejudice here, because if you look at what the jury supposedly found out from this exhibit, it was things that they already knew. And as the Supreme Court noted in Harrington versus Richter, when assessing prejudice under Strickland, the question is not whether a court can be certain that counsel's performance had no effect on the outcome, or whether it's possible that a reasonable doubt might have been established if counsel acted differently. The likelihood of a different result must be substantial and not just conceivable.
Your opposing counsel has spent some considerable time, and I think you should have the opportunity to be directed towards the idea of parsing out, and both parties spend a lot of time in their briefs talking about the fact, and both candidly acknowledge, as your opposing counsel did here today, that there is overwhelming evidence for both the trial court and the court of appeals and the parties. There's overwhelming evidence on the trafficking charges. And it is the sexual assault that is, as sexual assault cases, as a former prosecutor who took sexual assault cases to trial, they are often very difficult to prove for any number of reasons. And so the idea of parsing out the counts for purposes of ineffective assistance of counsel is at the forefront of this case. Now, in your brief, you say there's a dearth of precedent to say that, and one of the hypotheses you posit is that, well, gee, it's such an obvious point of law that maybe no one's discussed it. I'd like you to have you found any additional authority for the idea, or do you rest on the idea that it's so obvious? Or one of my readings is certainly that juries do not find, are not charged, and are not instructed by trial courts to determine guilt or they're not, to say innocence is imprecise, because juries are not tasked with finding innocence. They're charged with finding whether the state has met its burden of establishing guilt beyond reasonable doubt. They're not charged with doing so on the entire complaint or charging document. They are instructed on a count-by-count basis, and each count read, and the elements of each charge is then read. And so what is your argument today as to why we should give our imprimatur as a matter of law for courts to follow that, yes, when you are faced with this fact pattern, you may properly parse out and say there's overwhelming evidence on this charge, and Justice Kelly's hypothetical, one count each, that there's overwhelming evidence, so this passes muster, and on the other hand, the sexual assault does not, or in this case, several counts of trafficking and one count of sexual assault that does not.
The state's argument on that point, Justice Gableman, is there's no law directly assessing this fact pattern because Strickland plainly allows the courts to do what they did here. Strickland states that you don't just consider the unaffected findings when you're considering ineffective assistance. It says taking the unaffected findings as a given and then considering the affected findings and considering what effect that error might have had on the jury's finding of guilt, that's how you determine ineffective assistance, the prejudice prong of ineffective assistance of counsel. If we were only taking the unaffected findings as and assuming that those were all you could consider as to whether there was still an ability for the jury to find beyond a reasonable doubt that this person was guilty, we would be looking at whether there was any effect on the outcome of the proceeding. And that's simply not what Strickland directs courts to do. So, and I would like to point out as well, yes, there are no cases from any jurisdictions that have directly addressed this particular fact pattern, but there are no cases that have directly stated that this is impermissible either. And as I stated in my brief, I do really believe that the reason there's a lack of case law on point is because I think most of the time, counsel would look at what the Court of Appeals did here and simply not appeal it. Strickland plainly allows for this type of thing and says that you can't just only consider whether there was a conceivable effect on the outcome of the proceedings. It says that you have to determine whether the verdict would have been different, whether the judgment would have been different, and whether they would have had a reasonable doubt regarding guilt. And as you pointed out, juries don't determine guilt as an all-or-nothing proposition. They determine guilt on a count-by-count basis. Also, I think the test that Mr. Scholar is advocating for, I don't think he has considered what the effect on defendants actually would be if this court adopts this test. If prejudice can allow for an entire trial with multiple counts to be overturned if there was prejudice on any single one of them, that is going to provide a reason for prosecutors to want to charge defendants separately with every possible charge that they can to guard against this type of thing. And that means the defendant is then, instead of facing one trial, they're going to be facing six. The witnesses are going to have to come in six times. They're going to have to pay for an attorney to defend them six times. It's simply not, it's not in anyone's interest to adopt this type of test where which is essentially the lowest common denominator. If a person was prejudiced on the count with the least amount of evidence, you have to throw out everything. That simply, it doesn't recognize the society's interest in the administration of justice, and it doesn't benefit the defendant at all. It actually puts him in a worse position than he would have been in. So, Your Honors, I think that it's very clear from the language of Strickland and from the other United States Supreme Court decisions interpreting it that this is plainly how courts are supposed to go about assessing prejudice in an ineffective assistance of counsel context.
Counsel, you say it's very clear from the language of Strickland and other United States Supreme Court cases. Can you point me to the specific language that you would say makes this abundantly clear?
Yes, I can, Justice Kelly. Just give me one moment. Sorry. As I said, in Strickland, it says, when a defendant challenges a conviction...
Could you give the page, please?
Oh, yes, absolutely. It is 695.
Thank you.
466 U.S. 695. The United States Supreme Court says, when a defendant challenges a conviction, one conviction, The question is whether there is a reasonable probability that, absent the errors, the fact finder would have had a reasonable doubt respecting guilt. And then further on that same page and a little bit lower on 696, the court explains how courts are supposed to go about this. And it says that in making this determination, a court hearing an ineffectiveness claim must consider the totality of the evidence before the judge or jury. Some of the factual findings will have been unaffected by the errors, and factual findings that were affected will have been affected in different ways. Some errors will have had a pervasive effect on the inferences to be drawn, altering the entire evidentiary picture, and some will have an isolated trivial effect. Moreover, a verdict or conclusion only weakly supported by the record is more likely to have been affected by
counsel,
errors than one with overwhelming
record. Counsel, this is Shirley.
Yes,
this is Shirley Abrahamson. Counsel.
Yes, Justice, please go ahead.
Strickland runs throughout the criminal justice system and also the civil system, because many of the cases, like in civil commitments, use Strickland for prejudice. So for me, when we deal with Strickland, it's very important how we define prejudice, and because that's usually the more important prong here, and how we apply it, because it just runs the gamut of the law. And I worry that in these briefs and in the discussion, Strickland is applied as the court will weigh the evidence, and if it's overwhelmingly for somebody or against somebody, that finishes the matter. And I really don't think that's the Strickland test. Do you?
I'm sorry that Strickland doesn't say what?
I don't think Strickland says that the appellate court is, or trial court is, to weigh the evidence. And if it's overwhelming in one party's favor or opposed to it, that ends the matter.
No, you're correct, Justice. It doesn't say that. But it does recognize that conclusions that are supported by overwhelming evidence in the record are less likely to have been affected by an attorney error than those that are supported only weakly. And that's why I have repeatedly urged the justices of this court to look at this exhibit, because I think when you look at this exhibit, it will become very clear that there's simply not a reasonable probability that the jury would have had a reasonable doubt respecting guilt because of them being handed this exhibit. It's simply not as inflammatory as Mr. Schaller would like to make it out to be. And that's why I think the overwhelming evidence on the sexual assault charges come into play to such a degree here, is because there's simply no possibility that there would be a different result on the sexual assault charges in this case.
And counsel, if I could just close the loop on the language to which you refer in Strickland.
So
the reason that you come to the conclusion that this is done on a count-by-count basis is because when Strickland refers to whether there's a reasonable probability that a jury would develop reasonable doubt of guilt, it's because the jury operates on a count-by-count basis in determining guilt. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
I understood, though, your answer, your prior answer, to be a little bit different. I understood you to say that the conclusions that are supported by the counts that are supported by overwhelming evidence are less likely to be affected. That doesn't exclude the possibility that they are affected. That seems a little bit at tension with what I heard you just respond to with regard to Justice Kelly's question.
That's true, Justice Bradley. But then if you look at the very next few sentences of Strickland, it doesn't say that the court has to outright reject any findings that were affected. It then says that taking the unaffected findings as a given and taking due account of the effect of the errors on the remaining findings, a court making the prejudice inquiry must ask if the defendant has met the burden of showing that the decision reached reasonably likely would have been different absent the errors.
Would you please give me the page cite again from which you're
Absolutely.
Reading? Is it 698?
That is 696.
Six, okay. I have an additional question just for clarification. When asked whether or not you conceded, you being the state, conceded error vis-a-vis the count that was vacated, the sexual assault charge, I heard you very carefully answer. Good for you. And the answer was that, as I recall it, that you did not, the state chose not to file a cross appeal. I'm paraphrasing your answer, but essentially that was it. But then you went on, as I heard your answer, to talk or to reference your personal opinion on the issue. Do you intend that this, are you asking this court to address that issue, even though no cross appeal of it had been filed, that is, no cross appeal of the Mockner court's decision to vacate count five, the sexual assault charge? What's your position?
No, Justice Bradley, the state is not asking this court to redetermine deficient performance in this case. However, we do acknowledge that it's a question of law, and if this court decided to take it up, it absolutely has the authority to do so.
So, but your position is you're not asking us to?
That's true. Well, Justices, if no one else has any questions, I believe the state asks you simply to follow Strickland and to plainly allow what the courts have done here, especially in light of the overwhelming evidence and the small effect that this exhibit would have had on the jury.
Thank you very
Thank
much.
Thank you.
May I proceed?
Yes, please.
Thank you. The state, so I did a Westlaw search of cases that have shepherdized Strickland. By my count, that's 166,000 about. The state cannot
And when you read them all, how long did it
take? Okay, I did read all of them, but I can tell you that I searched for any court that has said that Strickland analysis in a multiple count trial, and the state acknowledges multiple count trials occur regularly, where any court has held that this division would be okay, or where any court has actually engaged in that division.
Sure, but let's think about it realistically. I mean, if you were going to make a real key point, I don't want to get in your way.
Well, I appreciate that, Justice Gableman, and the end of the point that I was going to make is
Please.
That I think the reason for that is that Strickland explicitly tells us this cannot be a harmless error style analysis. The style analysis that we're so used to on appeal cannot be the case here because Strickland says once you've established deficient performance, you've shown that the adversarial system has failed. So you cannot go back in retroactively as cleanly and just divide counts out.
But if we say, if we look at it, and this is what I'm, this is, this oral argument is helpful for a number of reasons, and one of them is this. It's helping to sort of crystallize a thought that had been forming, I think, as I'd been preparing for it, reading the briefs. And Ms. Comfort had made a reference to it, looking at it realistically. What purpose is served? I mean, if there's already a two-step process, determining deficient performance, and then we look at prejudice, and everyone agrees, the trial court, the court of appeals, it seems even counsel agree that there's overwhelming evidence on the trafficking counts. How is it contrary to Strickland? And I know what I've heard you say is,
thank you.
What I've heard you say is that it's something about the proceedings that the deficient performance has, for for lack of, I'm paraphrasing, contaminated the proceeding. But if there's overwhelming evidence on either one count or five counts, what purpose is served by sending it back for an entire new trial? In other words, there's no prejudice on those counts.
The purpose that is served is a defendant having his constitutional right to a fair trial. That, and Strickland tells us, that finality has to be lower, than it would in an outcome determinative analysis.
I'm familiar with Strickland, but the whole purpose of Strickland, it is to ensure a fair trial, but the way we measure whether a fair trial has occurred is whether, and we have to have a way to test. We have to have an articulable test that we give to our trial courts when they review whether a fair trial has occurred. And it might not be perfect, but it seems to have worked okay so far, which is to say, listen, did a mistake occur? Was there ineffective assistance? Yes. Did it prejudice? Yes. And if the way we determine prejudice is, would there have been, is there still, based on a total review of all of the evidence that has come in, what quantum of evidence was it harmful to the defendant? And if everyone seems to agree that the evidence that came in through this exhibit would not have disturbed, in other words, not just would not have disturbed, so it's not outcome determinative, but that it's overwhelming of guilt, I don't see how you can say that the purpose of Strickland, of the fairness of the trial, has not been served on those counts.
So my red light is on.
Yes, you may answer the question.
Thank
please.
You. So the one, I don't agree that the evidence here was overwhelming. We haven't agreed to that. There were a number of gaps in the state's evidence. The state had more evidence as to the other counts, but this was by no means a slam dunk. There were a number of problems in the evidence that they had. And Strickland tells us that the fundamental focus is fairness. And when we look at all of our case law concerning the danger of other acts' evidence, what we see is that it allows the jury to get to guilt for the wrong reasons. And so in this situation, yes, the jury decides guilt on each count, but the jury only has one deliberation. Strickland tells us that we have to consider what count or whether there would be fact findings that wouldn't be affected. Every fact finding here would be affected because of the jury being handed this exhibit during the deliberation. And contrary to the state's point, many, many of the pictures are not otherwise in the record, and that absolutely would have had an effect on the jury's, the inferences the state asked the jury to draw about whether he was guilty of the other charges. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you both for a very, very interesting Strickland case. You know, we've had Strickland forevermore, but this is the first time I've seen these arguments made. You both did a very good job, and the briefs were very, very helpful. So thank you so much.